RCE and 107.7 FM W299 CD Richland Center, and always on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Daria Albinger. President Biden announcing a $6 billion investment in semiconductor maker Micron to build factories in upstate New York and Idaho.
Together with Schumer Leader and I, we took action to make sure these chips were made in America again, creating tens of thousands, and I mean tens of thousands of good-paying jobs, bringing prices down for everyone.
He thanked New York's Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, for his help. A ruling is expected from the Supreme Court in June after justices today heard former President Trump's argument for absolute immunity from prosecution for attempting to overturn the 2020 election. The University of Southern California has canceled its main graduation ceremony as pro-Palestinian protests continue on campus. College officials nationwide are worried the demonstrations could disrupt their commencement plans too. Stocks closed lower today, the Dow falling more than 300 points. This is ABC News.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. The University of Wisconsin's flagship campus in Madison is slipping in the global and national rankings. The Wall Street Journal ranks it 79th. Internationally, UW-Madison has fallen to as low as 102nd in one ranking. Authors of the UW's internal studies say the UW-Madison gets fewer federal research grants. People who need a few hundred bucks in a hurry can take out loans on smartphone apps, but consumer advocates warn of steep hidden costs. Lucia Constantine is with the Center for Responsible Lending.
They are trapping consumers in a cycle of borrowing that is similar to that of a payday loan.
A bipartisan bill to curb predatory lending in Wisconsin stalled in the last session of the state legislature. And that's what you need to know. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
You're at the game with your girl, and you're going to pop the question. So you take a big swig of overpriced liquid courage. You pull the ring out of your pocket, get down on one knee, and then she says,
I need to go to the bathroom.
And you realize the whole stadium is watching.
Proposing on a Jumbotron? Big gamble. Ho-Chunk Gaming Wisconsin Dells? Better odds. We're your can't-miss hotspot for big-time casino fun. Ho-Chunk Gaming Wisconsin Dells. Your odds are better here.
This is News from the Center, WRCE.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. File this under Joe Biden did that. Starting July 1st, the overtime threshold for exemption will be $43,888, up from the current $35,568, and starting January 1st, that number will jump again up to $58,656, covering, well, about 4 million more workers in the new year with better wages. And, you know, these are going to help, you know, people who have been given titles. And I love this argument because I remember it during the Obama years really well, because most people hadn't really thought about this overtime threshold. You know, that's a working class thing. And I'm going, no, this is a worker thing. If you punch the clock for a living, if you do work for someone else, this should be important to you, because if they gave you a cute little title with a little gold plated thing with your name on it, assistant manager underneath, and at the time paid you $26,600 a year, they could work you 100 hours a week. Yeah, you know, and, you know, works out to be less than minimum wage, obviously. But hey, you're management because you're now exempt because you have some kind of official role where once in a while they make you tell some other worker what to do. So you're now exempt from all of this. And, you know, during the Obama years, they wanted to boost it up to 47,000. And of course, Republicans lost their mind. Donald Trump came in and they said, well, you know, we're gonna drop that Obama thing down, but we can't look like total tyrants. So they bumped it up to 35.5. And it's been stuck there since the early Trump years, even though inflation has gone up, as my red hat friends love to remind me. So this is Biden going, hey, in order to be exempt from minimum wage, you got to pay above this threshold. Now, again, these arguments are you know, digging back into the archives. Doesn't mean that, you know, you're going to have to pay a worker $58,656 a year to have them work for you. It means you have to pay them $58,656 if you want to exempt them from overtime. If you want them to work 41 hours and that 1 hour after 40 you don't want to pay overtime for, bang, that's what you got to pay. It doesn't mean that you can't, you know, pay them $58,656 an hour and work them 100 hours a week and then have to pay overtime. No, you can work them as much as you want if you pay that threshold, that number. That's simple. This is not a mandate that you have to. It does mean, though, that you have to respect your workers' time. It doesn't mean you can set up your business model on, you know, if I can just work these people more, if I could just work them till they burn out and leave and I can get the next person to come in and work them out till they burn out. This is saying, look, you know, 40 hours a week. After that, you pay time and a half. That's the law of the land. And what's happened over the last 50 years is that's been able to be eroded away. And it's one of those things that, you know, most working people, well, they're management. No, these are working people who are just given a nice title most of the time. Executive assistant, one of my favorite. I don't know what it means, but you're an executive assistant and you are now exempt from overtime because they said so. Because I guess the word executive is in there. And this is a big thing. But it's another one of those little things that this administration has moved forward on that will actually help working people. It's actually going to bring the wages up. Yesterday, we talked about the non-competes that the Federal Trade or the Department of Labor undid, and the Federal Trade Commission did away with these non-competes that said, hey, you know, peanut butter and jelly is proprietary. You can't go work across the street and flip burgers. Something in the wrist, we've taught you. You can't take that anywhere. It's all of these little things adding up to returning a reward to work. The fact that, you know, 4 million workers are gonna see an increase in wages or have more time in their life to do other things. The fact that millions of workers who were subjected to these non-competes are now going to be able to go, hey, I can go out into the market and test my wares. I wish they would do this for the forced arbitration clauses. I wish they would undo some of the really bad stuff that's happened over the last 50 years as well. But ultimately, what this is doing is it's moving us in this direction where we are returning reward to work. And it's the thing I ask out of every president that I've ever voted for. All I want is you to be the guy who returns reward to work. Brings back that moment of I believe in work hard, play by the rules, get ahead. And, you know, for 40 plus years, and we've been talking about this nonstop, you know, wages have been stagnant and declining. And it's only now after the pandemic, when inflation spiked because corporations are gouging us, have we now realized, we're struggling. Now, what the right has done masterfully is they've given people the red meat. The red meat is all Joe Biden's fault. Never mind all of the bad policies from Reagan forward. Never mind all of the neoliberalism and all the deregulation and all the allowing of monopolies to grow and all of that. Never mind that. It's Joe Biden's fault. Evidently, didn't know there's a switch under a drawer that, you know, every president knows it's there. It's the inflation. It's the cause pain button. And Biden, he's the guy who did it, evidently. This again, news to me, but I'll tell you, I am thrilled with the stuff that's coming out of this administration. And as working people, we should want more of it. Say, yes, please. Thank you. Yes, please. more, please. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Gonna take a quick break. When we come back, more on what we should be doing, more on how we reclaim our economy. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So ran into a red hat today who had to yell at me, "Let's go, Brandon!" And I got to be honest, I was feeling a little jaunty today, feeling a little ready to engage in some verbal combat. And I said, yeah. Let's go and reshore manufacturing. And yeah, let's go and reinvest in our infrastructure. And yes, let's go and save labor law and return reward to work. Yeah, let's go. Let's go after corporations who have been gouging us. Let's go after ending neoliberalism. Yeah, you're right. Let's go, Brandon. Poor guy didn't know what to say. Turned, walked away, head down. And this is what we've got to do to these folks. We've got to point out reality in this world of misinformation and disinformation where the red hats have been feeding themselves with a bunch of nonsense and hit them with things that are actually getting done and good stuff that is actually getting done. And that's why I've asked Bilal Baydoun to come talk with us. Bilal is the director of policy and research at the Groundwork Collaborative, one of my favorite groups doing incredible work out there. Bilal, thanks for taking time for us.
Such a pleasure to join you. Thanks for having me.
So, you know, look, I get this all the time. I get people, you know, Bidenomics is killing us and it's all Joe Biden's fault. Everything is Biden's fault. When the reality is it's corporate America has been sticking it to us, not just since the pandemic, but for the past 40, 50 years.
Absolutely. I mean, look, Americans are being gouged, ripped off, tricked, defrauded even all across product categories. I mean, the floodgates really are open, particularly after the pandemic when we had this bout of inflation that was very difficult for families. But at the same time, it provided cover for a lot of corporations to pursue tactics that in previous decades were considered unthinkable, especially when it comes to raising prices on folks. And so I think it's important now for everybody to wake up to this reality and realize that corporations are simply too powerful in this country.
Yeah. I mean, the greedy marriage of greedflation and shrinkflation harming families, and you can't walk away from that. But, you know, the sad reality is they've got an easy scapegoat because it's easy to go, it's Biden's fault, it's Bidenomics, it's let's go Brandon. And when you go without the reality of going, no, it's the greedy corporations, the guy you don't see in the white shirt sitting in the corner office going, hey, how do I line my pockets at the expense of everybody else?
That's exactly right. In some cases, it's even easier than that. Sometimes it's an algorithm that's just used to calculate, you know, the max price that a company should charge you. Sometimes it's, you know, software that's deciding how much rent you should pay or the cost of the beef that you pick up from the supermarket. It's gotten awfully easy to rip people off in this country. And I think we have to start rolling that back.
Now, I saw something like this that came out of the Federal Trade Commission not too long ago on this algorithmic pricing in the rental market, I think it was, where they were saying, you know, this is unfair competition. Even if two, you know, sets of landlords aren't directly talking to each other by using this algorithm, they kind of are.
That's exactly right. I mean, look, I think folks understand intuitively that if you're a landlord and there's a landlord across the street and the two of you meet up for a barbecue and decide, you know what, we're going to raise prices on this block. That is collusion. Now, if you do that via an algorithm, it's still collusion, and collusion is illegal. And so I think that's the message that the FTC put out, not just in housing, but also with meat processing firms and other firms as well. And so there's no hiding behind an algorithm. And thankfully, we do have a Federal Trade Commission that has revived antitrust in a way to really be the American people's eyes and ears when it comes to some of these tricks and deceptive practices.
But again, you know, I look at housing and the fact that rents have gone up so high. Everybody I talk to saying that they're getting gouged for rent. And look, there's not much they can do about it, because where are you going to go? It seems like they've all done it, and they've all done it at about the same rate. So that idea that, hey, I'll go across the street, I'll go across town where it might be cheaper, that doesn't seem to exist. Is that, do you think, because of this algorithm?
I mean, it's certainly part of it. I mean, if you don't like a rent price, you should be able to pick yourself up and say, I'm going somewhere else. I'm going to go to this other neighborhood. But if all the landlords are using the same algorithm to determine the prices, the maximum price that you'll pay, and they determine those prices using information and inputs that you don't have access to, then you're always going to be on your heels, and you're always going to be at a disadvantage. It's really a form of collusion that we have to put an end to.
Because it's all of this stuff. You know, I mean, the reality is I was told, 100 years ago when I was in college, that the free market was, about competition, and that to be part of a free market, you would have the ability to abstain from that, from purchasing it or not purchasing it, or purchase from somewhere else. The sad reality, you look at housing, you don't really have much of a choice. You need it. And if all of the inputs and all of the things that you are looking at are, well, not competing, that's not the free market.
No, it's not. And in fact, we suffer from a lack of competition throughout the economy. Corporations are too powerful. They don't face competition, certainly not like they used to. About 75% of U.S. industries today are dominated by fewer players than they were 20 years ago. And so what we're seeing today is, the sort of confluence of immense market power, immense lobbying power, but also technological changes that give that power additional tools that are more powerful and more harmful. And so it's important for regulators and Congress and really all people of conscience to stand up and say, enough.
I was talking about this earlier today with someone about our labor laws. And you go, the majority of our labor laws were written in the 1930s, nearly 100 years ago. A lot of these rules that we're talking about, kind of the same scenario. It seems like most of the legislation and the laws that we're living in that were supposed to help with competition and save capitalism are decades old. And no one could have ever imagined that a computer would be able to, be the middleman between everyone to set the price. Is this a place where we need to start updating some of our laws and answer it? I mean, the Federal Trade Commission, the laws that they operate under, how old are those?
Absolutely. I mean, things like the Sherman Antitrust Act, I mean, these go way back. But I think what the FTC has done a really good job of is simply applying those older standards to more modern situations, and saying, if you use an algorithm, that's no different than you using a human agent to sort of be the middleman to help you collude on prices. And so it's really just, taking those principles and making sure we're applying them correctly. And at the same time, we do need new laws. That's why, interventions like Senator Bob Casey has a Shrinkflation Prevention Act to classify practices like shrinkflation, which, by the way, is the practice when you shrink the size of a product without lowering its price. And it's a sort of deceptive practice. That bill seeks to classify it as a deceptive practice and therefore deem it illegal. And so those newer interventions are really important. Similarly, Senator Elizabeth Warren has a bill called the Price Gouging Prevention Act. And what that would do is it would really disincentivize companies from using the cover of these economic emergencies like the pandemic, which was really painful for people, like inflation, like natural disasters, and to not use the cover of those events to arbitrarily jack up prices and keep them high. And so it's going to be a combination of both. And thankfully, we are seeing progress on both fronts.
What do you say to the argument that we live in a capitalist country, Bilal, and the manufacturers, the producers can charge whatever they want. It's the consumer's choice to whether to purchase them or not. Because I've argued, look, if the price of eggs is too much, don't buy them. And that's how you bring the price down. Is there a way the consumer can go, you know what, we're done until you start treating us fairly? Or do you not see that as something possible in this day and age?
Look, I'm old enough to remember when, you know, companies had to compete for my business, had to innovate, had to invent, had to find all of these ways to really signal to consumers that, hey, you should buy my product. That's not what's happening today. Today, it's the using the muscle of market dominance to strong arm consumers into paying higher prices and extracting profits as a result. And so, look, should corporations be able to pursue profits? Of course, and they do. But should corporations be able to price gouge people? No. I think all of your listeners know intuitively that if you're in the middle of a hurricane and there's somebody on the corner selling water bottles for $20 a bottle, that is wrong. There's nothing free about that. That is exploitation, and exploitation is wrong. And in many cases, it's illegal.
So the question I keep coming back to is, how did we get here? I mean, I have a theory of how we ended up in this situation where we've got a handful of corporations that control industry after industry. And, the power that they have to hold down wages, to increase prices, to do all of the things that I think the average person would find, deplorable. How did we get to this point? What allowed this to happen over all of these years to where, because I like you, I'm old enough to remember where there were multiple companies who were fighting for your business, and they would, hey, we're going to give you 20 cents off this week or a buck off, or, hey, we got this bonus. There was always something. It seems like, well, not so much.
Right. I mean, as you mentioned with neoliberalism, we're hopefully emerging out of this half a century consensus of not regulating corporations, not taxing corporations, really allowing corporations to do whatever they want. And what we found is, towards the end of that period, once corporations, outsourced jobs, once they began to evade taxes, once they cut costs to the bone, there's nothing left to cut. And so now, the only thing they could do to satisfy Wall Street and satisfy their shareholders is to jack up prices. Yeah. And so that's where we are. Now, the difference in why this moment is particularly dangerous is because they're not just raising their sticker prices. They're using new technology to raise prices in such a way that, something really central that we all take for granted, that we will know what things cost before we pay for them, that might be dissipating in this country. And so we have to really preserve that basic fairness that, you and I, Rick, should not have to pay a different price for the same product, based on our browsing history, based on, how low our battery is, which is something Uber was accused of doing. This is just simply a combination of market power run amok, of less competition, of low taxation, and ultimately of a once in a century opportunity, which the pandemic was, to deploy some really predatory tactics that were previously thought to be unthinkable.
I remember the low battery thing, and you go, you can't make that up. You couldn't dream that up to make that reality. And I look at concert tickets. I remember a day where you could go to the box office and you could buy it for what the ticket said. Now, good luck finding a box office, and everything is on one of the big apps. And then the fees that they charge, the incredible amount of fees for doing literally nothing is what's the convenience fees and the service fees and the fees for fees for fees. It's crazy, which is why I'm glad, Biden and them are saying, look, these junk fees that they keep adding on to everything, that's got to stop.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's got to stop. When you put your, when you go on Uber Eats, and you order a cheeseburger, it says one price when you start that process. And then lo and behold, the moment you go to check out and pay, the price changes and it goes up. When you're filing for your taxes, you might use TurboTax. In the beginning, it's advertised as a free service. And, you're 45 minutes into entering all your income and all these complicated documents. And of course, you have to upgrade to the deluxe version to continue. So look, this is just deception. And Thankfully, many of our regulatory agencies have recognized it as such. But I should also, I really want to point out why, an additional reason why these practices are dangerous. We simply don't have access to the same information that these firms do when they're setting prices. And so it's simply unfair that these firms know so much about us, we know very little about them, and that asymmetry of information really puts us, really puts them in an advantaged position.
No, I mean, our data, you know, the fact that, you know, corporate America knows so much about all of us and that we don't even know what they know about us, which is the part that I find scariest of all. That's something that I've been talking about for years, that we're so far behind the curve probably the rest of the world, but so far behind the curve that I don't know that we ever get out of it.
Yeah, look, we have to regulate these big companies. And you know, I think part of the problem is the incentive to price gouge is so big. And the reason why it's so big is because companies know that they're going to keep more of the profits if they pursue a lot of these predatory tactics. Yeah. And so this is really where low taxation, for example, comes in. Again, if you know that you're going to be able to keep more of the spoils, you're going to pursue those profits more aggressively and in more harmful ways than you otherwise would. And so I think, look, we're coming upon a tax fight in 2025, and we should really be thinking about how the tax code could be used to shape corporate behavior and to restore fairness to our economy.
No, because we were told, and what we were sold on was if we give corporations all of these tax breaks, that they would then create jobs and we would get those jobs, and then it would trickle down in higher wages and all kinds of stuff. And that has not happened. What has happened is their profits have gone through the roof, and stock buybacks keep going up, and you know, CEO's salary keeps going up, and the wealthy, we've got a billionaire class richer than ever in the history of humanity, and it's still not enough.
It's still not enough, and it'll never be enough, and that's really why rules are important. And I think when you sort of cut corporate taxes, when you cut regulations, you're basically saying there's no referee, there are no rules, and you're free to run roughshod over the American people. And that's really why we're in the position that we're in today, yeah, with an affordability crisis, why people can't afford homes. And so we have to really address these practices head on.
So last question I've got for you. What do we do? What do average everyday Americans do? I know voting is a huge part of this. You know, I know November's coming. I fear the potential of a return of the Orange Menace. But what do people do in this situation? Because I know a lot of people feel helpless, because these corporations are so big, so powerful. What do we do?
People have to first understand that we are the economy, that the economy goes as far as we take it. And the we here is everyone. It's our workers. It's our families. And it's not corporations who create all the value in our economy. So I think just starting with that basic point, that really dignifying point that we are the economy, and call your representatives and say, I'm tired of being ripped off. I'm tired of being ripped off at the grocery store. I'm tired of being ripped off on my car insurance, on my tax filing. There are so many opportunities for corporations to rip us off. And we do have the tools, whether it's antitrust, whether it's taxation, or whether it's new legislation, as we've seen. We do have the tools to rein this in, and it's not a foregone conclusion that we will be susceptible to corporate profiteering and predatory practices. We could change this, and I think we need to act like it.
I know I said last question, line of questioning, but you know, this follows up on that. Do you think the Biden administration is moving in that direction? Do you think the Lena Khans and the Jonathan Cantors, do you think the people who he's put into place has done some of this, is moving us in the right direction? And I want to get your thoughts on what you think a return of Trump would do to any of this stuff.
Look, I think those agencies you mentioned have done an excellent job. I would also add in the Department of Justice's Antitrust Division. I'd also add in the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which, you know, just implemented an incredible late fees rule that'll save Americans billions of dollars a year on late fees that are totally unjustifiable. So, look, I think they're doing an excellent job. I think it's going to take a lot more time to roll back so much of what's transpired in a more lax regulatory environment over the last, you know, 40 to 50 years, and in some cases longer. But I think they're on the right track. As far as, as far as the election,
I'm not worried about the election. During the Trump years, he chose people to head up these organizations. You got to assume he's going to get the old gang back again. Would those folks do any of this stuff that's moving us in the right direction?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I think corporate capture is real. And, you know, when these agencies are headed up by people who, put the interests of corporations ahead of the public, you get what you get. And so I'm thankful that that's not the position we're in now. And we have agencies that really do have the public interest at heart when they set out and, make rules and regulations and just make sure that the game is fair.
I'm right there with you. Bilal, I appreciate you taking some time for us, sharing your thoughts. As always, I appreciate the work that you guys do. Keep it up.
Absolutely. Pleasure to join you.
Good stuff. Bilal Badoun, Director of Policy and Research there at the Groundwork Collaborative. Want to hear your thoughts. Are we heading in the right direction? Do you think going after these big corporations, breaking some of this stuff up, undoing 40 years of neoliberalism is a good thing? I know I do, but I want to hear it. Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
You're listening to News from the Center, WRCE.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Mostly clear skies here in the overnight, upper 30s by sunrise, and southeast winds will be breezy on Friday. Southeast winds increasing to over 30 miles per hour. Some showers in the afternoon. And our high temperatures will reach the upper 50s. It's 50 at our studios.
What is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is Dariano. We call him Day Day for short. Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, quick shout out to my buddy Randy Corrigan, principal officer out in Teamsters Local 1932. Out in San Bernardino. You may remember we talked to him last week about the rally they were going to have in front of the NLRB building in California, out in Los Angeles. And they had a big thing planned. Well, the NLRB reached out and said, "Hey, let's talk. Let's sit down and work this out." So they postponed the rally in lieu of what these talks could bring. This is the power of direct action. When people are getting out in the streets and exercising their power, when workers realize and exercise their power, good things happen. So I'm excited to see what comes out of these conversations. And look, maybe there's a rally coming. I always love a good rally. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the top news of labor this week. I've asked our good friend Michael Sonato to come talk with us. He's one of the best labor reporters in the country, does some reporting over at The Guardian US, someone I follow quite often. Michael, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So, there's so much going on. The UAW's historic victory, a lot of people talk about, this is going to open up the South. We're going to organize the South. What are you hearing?
It's definitely a big sea change of, what's going on. 10 years ago, they lost their two last big elections, 2014, 2019, and this one was a blowout, 73%, right around there. Just watching the UAW now, it's not just Sean Fain, it's the tactics. As soon as Volkswagen started doing their union busting, they filed a ULP charge, and they were very aggressive and adamant about, if you're going to union bust, we're going to go to the public, we're going to go to the press, we're going to scream our heads off about it because you're violating the law. And that Volkswagen really pulled back. Mercedes is doing it a little bit more, but still, you know, they're, you know, pushing against that. And I've seen that with, you know, the Amazon workers in the in Kentucky with their NLRB. So I've been seeing unions do. It used to be like a union would file a ULP charge. We never really hear about it. There wouldn't be media coverage, and it would just take like a year until, you know, that got either settled or the National Labor Relations Board made a ruling. So I think that's a different welcome tactic to, you know, people smartening up and being exposed to, oh, this is what union busters and anti-union people say. And I think we're seeing the result of, you know, people not being swayed and that fear and intimidation not working because the labor movement has kind of exposed these things to the mainstream. And, you know, I think that's a big sea change. We had governors throughout the South vote, you know, wrote a letter trying to scare workers into saying, don't unionize. Didn't work. And, you know, years ago, that would have been...
Well, it did work. But I would also argue, Michael, and I got to throw in there, I think a lot of this energy comes because Joe Biden is in the White House. Because you've got an NLRB that's willing to listen. You've got an NLRB that's helping elections move along at a quicker pace. And look, this is why my buddy out in California is saying, look, we're going to protest the NLRB because they're going to listen and we can push them along to start making some of those decisions a little bit quicker, because that was their complaint. How long does it take to get these people who have been unjustly fired back to work? How long does it come to come up with decisions on this stuff? And if we've got a more responsive NLRB who is there to do the work of the mission of the organization, then we've got opportunities to organize, I think.
No, absolutely. Because, you know, even under Obama, that really wasn't the case. Didn't have, and it, you know, people can, you know, criticize and want more from Joe Biden. But the fact that, you know, you do have a president and a National Labor Relations Board. You do have, you know, the, you know, I was a couple of weeks ago, I listened to Jennifer Abruzzo, the general counsel for the NLRB, vocally respond to Amazon and SpaceX and Starbucks, all saying, claiming that the NLRB is unconstitutional. You know, you have those people, you know, Julie Sue is on, you know, you look on her Twitter, she's saying things that are very pro-union, they're very active. All those things, I think, come together. You know, that fear dissipates. It's hard to gauge how much that is, but you know, when you have the authority figures kind of highlighting and signaling, like, no, you have the right to do this, and you know, it kind of undermines the ability of other power structures to instill fear in workers.
No, I mean, look, I've said for years, if I were advising a company of how to break a union campaign, first thing you do is you fire somebody, because the penalties for firing someone are so pathetic and meager that it would be political malpractice not to. And under an old NLRB who would keep someone out, you know, 2-3 years, and this fight would just take on and on and on, you know, there was no downside to it. Now, do we need major comprehensive labor law reform? Absolutely. We need to put some more teeth in this law so that when they do fire someone illegally, they get bitten in the behind. But, you know, right now, I think what they're doing at the NLRB is moving us in the right direction. And oh, for my red hat friends, yeah, Joe Biden did that.
No, I agree. And yeah, there's a lot more that needs to be done, but it's a change of pace that, you know, the past few years, and you know, yeah, it will continue if he's, you know, reelected.
And the energy that you've seen come out of this campaign, I think, is going to be contagious, and I hope is going to be that spark that just sets the South on fire with organizing. I got to get some of your thoughts on what's going on at Starbucks. I know that, and I mean, shocked to me that Starbucks is going to sitting down and supposedly negotiating. But what's going on there? I haven't heard a lot recently. What's going on?
Both sides have kind of kept it under wraps about, you know, what's going on. And it really does poke holes. And, you know, Starbucks throughout it claimed they were bargaining in good faith. So, you know, obviously they weren't if there's a new framework that they're actually going to sit down and bargain with. But I think that comes with just the courage and bravery of workers within the Starbucks campaign and, you know, at different Starbucks that continue to push, continue to file. You know, the firings, the intimidation, the union busting certainly had a chilling effect, but it didn't defeat them. And I think Starbucks, you know, they had to give up to some extent. But, you know, they still are fighting cases at the National Labor Relations Board. This week they are hearing their case related to the Memphis 7 and the Supreme Court, given the makeup of the Supreme Court. And the arguments made this week, it seems like the Supreme Court's going to rule in their favor, and that has to do with 10J injunctions ordering fired workers to be reinstated, which is what happened in Memphis, even though the board has pointed out that it doesn't matter what the two-prong or the four-prong, you know, they've had similar outcomes. It's not like, that, you know, Starbucks acts like the NLRB is just rubber stamping getting fired workers reinstated when that's not really the case. And
well, if you're firing someone for, you know, concerted activities, yeah, they should rubber stamp it. It should be the next day you go back to work. You know, and you know, my problem with a lot of these firings is, you know, you make up nonsense. Because we live in a country where you don't have a right to a job. You're an at-will employee. So corporate America goes, I don't need a reason to fire. I just, there's the door. And in these cases, I'm glad the NLRB is being a little more difficult in allowing them to fire people.
Yeah, as they should, because I think around 30 to 40 Starbucks workers have gotten that reinstatement ordered. And, you know, I think the union said like it's around over 200 workers. A lot of those workers, you know, just didn't file unfair labor practice charges because it's a lot of work.
Yeah,
it's a lot of time and it could take, you know, this happened with the Memphis 7. This happened years ago. The workers are still working there and Starbucks is still fighting it in the Supreme Court. So there's Starbucks workers making drinks right now in Memphis. Related to this case that Starbucks still wants to fire, even though they've been reinstated and still there for over a year. It's just ridiculous.
Well, do you think that's part of the push by, you know, the Amazons, by the you know, the Teslas, by the Starbucks, the Trader Joe's, who want to have the NLRA ruled unconstitutional and thus throwing, you know, labor relations in this country into chaos? Do you think this is a part of that?
Absolutely. They want to undermine that how weak labor law is, the little power that they do have. They don't want to listen to it. That's why they appeal. They delay. They fight. They've never said, oh, we screwed up. Oh, we didn't mean to. Oh, we actually did union bust. Like, it's never been done with all these companies. But we know Amazon, Starbucks, Trader Joe's, they've all done it. They've egregiously, disgustingly, they've hurt their own workers. It's definitely a part of that. They don't want to be told, you know, what to do, and they don't want to uphold workers' rights to organize. They do not respect that. Howard Schultz doesn't. Jeff Bezos and his now, you know, Andy Jassy, they don't. Amazon is still fighting. You know, I think later this month, the Alabama second rerun election is finally, the objections to that are going to be adjudicated. So, you know, they still haven't bargained with JFK 8, the one warehouse in the U.S. to have unionized. That is a failure of labor law. That is ridiculous. Workers shouldn't have to wait over 2 years and not have one bargaining session.
This is why I keep coming back to, you know, one of the things I liked about the Employee Free Choice Act is it tripled the fees, the fines for illegally firing someone, but it mandated a first contract. And there was a time schedule at which you had to get that first contract, because corporate America, even if you do win the election, if you win the vote, it doesn't mean necessarily you're going to get a contract. And I look at, you know, at the UAW and Volkswagen, I think with a 73% win, I think it's going to make it a lot easier. And with it being a German company and the laws that they have in Germany, going to be a lot easier. But, you know, it's not assured.
And that is just a failure of labor law. Yep. It's a broken part of labor law. It should be. Companies can just say, oh, we're bargaining in good faith and not actually do it, like Starbucks had been doing. And the only power workers have is to but what Starbucks workers did, they held strikes, they held, they pushed, campaigns and different things around like Red Cup Day and things like that, pushing investors and shareholders and kind of, I think a big thing right before Starbucks turned was they were pushing investors to reveal how much money you're actually paying Littler Mendelson and these union avoidance consultants. How many millions of dollars are you throwing away? And that's ultimately hurting shareholders, because that would either go back in the business of Starbucks or could go to shareholders, dividends, or could go to improving wages. But they have millions of dollars to spend on this.
Here's where I make the argument a little differently. I don't think the shareholders care how much they're spending on union busting, because the argument you make to it is, hey, if we can cheat those workers out of wages and health care, retirement and all that stuff, if we can cheat them out of any say on the job and ensure that we can have complete dictatorial control over wages, hours, conditions, it's gonna make you more money. So you shouldn't care how much we spend on union busting and abusing our workforce, because they're going to make you more profit by not demanding higher wages. That's the argument I think that they make.
I completely agree with that. Yeah, but
I want them to make that argument. I want them to say that out loud, because it's what they believe.
Unless you're a CEO, then you get wage increases, even if your company is losing money.
Yeah. Everyone's got a golden parachute. Finally, I got to get your thoughts on this coming Sunday, April 28th, is International Workers' Memorial Day. That's the day that those of us who have had friends and loved ones killed on the job, where we remember them. And then hopefully want to do something better in the future to make sure workplaces are safer, to make sure that people are held accountable. But sadly, I don't see much changing in the way of protecting workers the way I would like to see it. But I agree with Mother Jones. We mourn the dead. We fight like hell for the living. I wanted to get your thoughts. You've been doing some really good reporting around this. What do you see?
I see in OSHA agency that's underfunded, the budget for the agency's not been keeping up just over the past decade. There's been legislation to modernize it, to expand it, because a lot of states don't have their own OSHAs, which certainly aren't up to standard. And you have government employees that aren't covered. You have swaths of workers who aren't covered by OSHA, and then you have basic protections like heat protections that workers every summer, there's stories of workers dying in heat. It's just basic protections they need: water, rest, shade, breaks. Not expensive at all, but you have trade groups, industrial groups fighting tooth and nail. They passed a bill in DeSantis in Florida, here in Florida, banning any cities from passing heat protection laws, because Miami-Dade County was on the path to do that. And it's just disgusting. People don't think about how, I know safety isn't as sexy as organizing and winning and all those things, but it's like a really important part. Every worker deserves to be able to go home at the end of the day to their families. All these deaths are preventable. Many of these stories just aren't told. They're just lost in the data of OSHA. Over 5,000 workers that just we know of that's reported die in the U.S. every year on the job from, things like falls, transportation incidents, killed in all sorts of, disgusting ways that are avoidable. And, I've covered it, you've seen it, just OSHA They just give a little fine and the employer is back to profiting and, you know, making millions. And, you know, a lot of these companies are continuing to violate, you know, workers' rights to a safe workplace. So and educating people and getting people aware of like what these dangers are, what these hazards are, and, you know, how to prevent them and why and how employers don't do that. Is just an ongoing challenge.
It's amazing to me, and I get the newsletters every day and the press releases from the OSHA subscription service, and it's amazing to me how little some of these fines are and how much you know, and it's by statute. It's not because OSHA says, oh well, we've decided that we're gonna give $10,000 or whatever in fines. It's because the laws are written so badly. That protect corporations. And I've always said, Michael, if I really wanted to kill somebody, I would just give them a job, because I don't know that we ever prosecute people who, you know, have conditions where people die on the job. But you know, here's where we are. So Sunday, Workers' Memorial Day. I hope we have at least the moment to think about the workers who have lost their lives on the job. But Michael Sonato, appreciate the time, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me again.
Michael Sonato, I got to tell you, one of the best labor reporters in the country. Make sure you check out his work over at The Guardian. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. This is The Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1978. That was the day of an important victory for any woman in the United States with a pension. The Supreme Court handed down its decision in a case known as Los Angeles Water Department versus Manhart. Manhart and a group of current and past female employees at the department had sued. The women were required to pay more into their pension than were the men. The reason for this policy was that women lived longer on average. That meant that the 2,000 women employed at the water department had to contribute nearly 15% more than their 10,000 male co-workers. The women argued that this violated Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which prohibited discrimination based on gender. The case wound its way through the court system. The ACLU filed a brief in support of the women's cause at the U.S. Supreme Court. The women won their case in a 6-2 decision. The majority of justices decided that even if women lived longer than men as a group, it would be impossible to know how long each individual woman might live. Therefore, individual women could not be held to a different standard for their pension. The case was an important affirmation of the protections of the Civil Rights Act. Yet despite this victory, the women were not returned any of the extra money they had been required to pay into their pensions. Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens, writing for the majority, found that such retroactive payments could be, quote, devastating for a pension fund. He wrote that, quote, administrators of retirement plans must be given time to adjust gradually to Title VII's demands. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So again, Sunday, the 28th of April, it will be Workers' Memorial Day. And look, this is one of those days, you know, for me anyway, because I've known several people over the years who have died at work. And it's tragic. It's harmful for the families. It tears apart the workforce. It's nothing good in this. And look, I got to think on a certain level, it hurts corporations as well. Now, you know, the reality is we've done a really poor job over the years of the last several years of protecting workers. What OSHA had done in the beginning, stopping lots of deaths, lots of injuries. You know, we're in a moment, and I saw this study not too long ago that pointed out that we're at like a 45-year low. This was back in 2020, a 45-year low of the number of inspectors who are on the job at OSHA. They said that, you know, in 2020, there were 862 inspectors, which is down from 952 in 2016 and 1,006 in 2012. And look, you know, the Reagan era gutted all of that stuff because it really was about gutting regulatory oversight. It really was about gutting the guardrails of capitalism. It was really about gutting those protections for workers because we got job-killing regulations. What I found interesting to inspect every workplace in this country under OSHA's purview would take 165 years. So the reality is it's a reactive organization, not proactive, like I would like it to be. I would like people not to die on the job. That's kind of what we want. What I found interesting is you remember when DeSantis signed that bill, that preemption bill that said, hey, Miami, no, you can't protect workers in your community, that OSHA had released a statement that they had fined a corporation because a 26-year-old guy who had come here from Mexico to work in South Florida worked 4 days, died on the job from heat-related injuries. And, you know, you go down the list of, you know, all of the failures and all of the things that happened, and you get to the punchline, which is this McNeil Labor Management. They face a maximum penalty of $27,655, an amount set by federal statute, to highlight just what I said. Look, you know, the reality is the laws have been written in a way to, well, protect corporate interests at the expense of working people. Now, look, OSHA is important. We need to ensure safe workplaces. We need to prevent workplace illnesses and injuries. We need to help promote mental health. We need to protect vulnerable workers. We need to be doing all of those things so that when you go home at the end of the day, you go home in the same condition you showed up in. Because after all, we work to live, not live to work. But from a corporate perspective, from the business perspective, you want what comes out of safer workplaces, which is improved productivity, reducing healthcare costs, happy workers. And, oh, by the way, growth. If you've got happy workers and more productive workers, you've got more stuff done. And it's always been amazing to me that employers don't get that. That, you know, butting heads with their workforce or illegally firing people for no reason, you know, it doesn't create a great environment. And this is one of those moments where you go, hey, we can fix this stuff. We can create safe work environments so people want to go to work and want to do their best and not have to worry about, hey, am I going to make it home tonight? Now, accidents do happen, but most of them are preventable. And this is where having a proactive OSHA instead of a reactive OSHA would be helpful. This is where having a little more responsibility put on the employers, I don't know, a little helpful. But all we hear from Republicans is, you know, job-killing regulations. We need to cut and gut. And it's what they've done over the last 40 years. And OSHA is just one of the many organizations that have seen massive cuts over the years. And, you know, while their mission is growing bigger and bigger and bigger, because obviously the number of people in the workforce are growing, the number of inspectors and the people who are supposed to be there to help keep dwindling because their budgets keep dwindling. Same thing with the NLRB, same thing with the EPA, all of this stuff. We have not done a very good job of holding corporate America in check. And that's by design. That is not a failure of those institutions by any stretch of the imagination. It is, in fact, by design. And as I say, all the things that people go, wow, you know, they're failing. Look at how bad this is working. By design. Because while bad things are happening to working people, trust me, the folks at the top, they're cashing in. And they're cashing in a big way. Because at the end of the day, do they really care about their workforce? Some do. I do have to question the big picture. It's always seemed to me to be profit over people. At some point, we've got to have a government that's saying, no, we're going to protect we the people. Just my thought. Want to hear yours? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally, and I'd love to hear, especially the angry ones. I've gotten some really angry ones lately. You missed any of the show? Podcast for the audio, ricksmithshow.com. That's where you go to get that. Also, video. You want to check out the video over freespeech.org. As always, appreciate you being here. Look forward to having you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com.
This is News from the Center, 1450 AM WRCE and 107.7 FM W299 CD Richland Center. And always.